listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, CKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, CJTM in Toronto, at CFMU in Hamilton, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network has become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from a progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we look at how Doug Ford's dismantling Ontario at Press Progress sources, make the case for a digital detox on Tech Won't Save Us, and explain why actually drinking urine isn't the true universal remedy for all diseases and disorders on Seriously Wrong. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism daily, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, Maisonneuve Magazine in Montreal, The Grind newspaper in Toronto, the MB Media Co-op in Moncton, The Independent in St. John's, plus national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 23 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at Unrigged.ca. The Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from an archived December 2020 episode, the team sits down with Crackdown's Garth Mullins and The Progress Report's Jeremy Appel to unpack the Alberta UCP government's pursuit of an abstinence-only drug use model that rejects harm reduction approaches. Now, here's the show.
The Alberta Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Check out our partner shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. This independent listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage. Hello and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I'm your host, Kate Jacobson. Late on the afternoon of Friday, December 18th, the government of Alberta announced updated numbers regarding the opioid crisis in Alberta. So in today's episode, we are going to talk about addiction recovery capitalism and specifically how Alberta is shoveling public dollars into the pockets of private recovery providers, often with very dubious results. Joining me here on Team Advantage today is Jeremy Appel, author of a recent Progress Alberta piece titled The Alberta Model: Who Benefits from the Alberta Government's Shift Away from Harm Reduction to Abstinence-Only Recovery? Jeremy, thank you for joining me here on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Long time, first time.
Also joining us today on the Alberta Advantage from Vancouver, British Columbia, is activist, writer, broadcaster, musician, and host of the Crackdown podcast, Garth Mullins. Garth, we are very big fans of your podcast, so thank you for joining us here on Team Advantage.
Well, same back at you, and thanks for having me again.
So to begin, I think we should set the scene for our listeners a bit. As of this recording, there have been 841 deaths from COVID-19 in Alberta. What has received a lot less attention, however, is the fact that there has been 904 deaths from opioid poisoning in Alberta in the first 9 months of 2020. And this statistic may have our listeners asking themselves, what is Jason Kenney and the government of Alberta doing with a health crisis that is killing more people than COVID-19? Jeremy, since you wrote a piece about it, what has been Jason Kenney and the UCP's attitude towards addiction treatment and the public health crisis surrounding it?
So I would generally characterize it as being actively hostile to people who use drugs and solutions that will keep them alive. At the same time, as we'll see, the government is exceedingly generous towards not-for-profit abstinence-only clinics that sort of involves an approach of moralizing to people who do drugs that what they're doing is bad and they need to stop. An example of this is the Associate Minister of Addictions and Mental Health, Jason Lewan, wrote an op-ed in the Edmonton Journal where he said, addiction does not exist in drugs. It exists in people. Therefore, the solution exists in people and not in tinkering with the drug supply. And so as I put in the piece, according to this view, the problem is you. And the only way that you can get better is through abstinence. And if you can't abstain, the implication is that you're a failure. This is despite there being clear evidence that drug supply is indeed the issue at hand. That's what's killing people. The pandemic in particular has led to an increasingly toxic supply as borders close and illicit supply chains are disrupted. In October, for instance, police in Victoria seized a supply of fentanyl that 90% concentration. That's compared with a usual 10% concentration. So that's really powerful fentanyl. And if you look a bit west to BC, they are tackling this issue with safe supply programs and have for quite some time. But to the UCP government, that approach is just out of the question because they've embraced this extreme abstinence-focused strategy that runs counter to best practices as there's much evidence to back up.
In fact, it's so bad that Lewan's chief of staff, Marshall Smith, has stated that, and I quote, "I think that there is a certain shroud of stigma that needs to remain around addiction." So a just truly like grotesque way of approaching this issue, and one that's really devoid of any compassion and is extremely dangerous. One thing I do think might be useful here is to define our terms a bit for our listeners. So what is a safe supply program and what is the difference between a harm reduction model of addiction recovery versus an abstinence-only model of addiction recovery?
I came up in the time of DARE and you know, to say no and all that. And I think that's still very much alive in Alberta. And that's abstinence. It's just like, you should not use drugs. And there are perhaps people who can get there. But when the drug supply is so toxic, it's hard because, if you could die from using once, you might never get the chance to pursue abstinence. So it's not appropriate to an overdose crisis. So yeah, abstinence is just no drugs, like a 12-step program that is like no drugs, no methadone. That's it. You know, harm reduction accepts that people do use drugs. This does happen and they try to reduce the harms that come with it. So like, for example, the first harm reduction I experienced in my life was when someone gave me a new needle so that I didn't have to use an old dull one, or even worse, potentially share with other people. And at every step of the way, there have been conservative voices, you know, from the federal government or local conservatives in Alberta or in British Columbia saying, no, 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 we shouldn't give out syringes. No, 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 we shouldn't prescribe methadone. No, 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 we shouldn't prescribe, you know, what they call safe supply, like other types of opioids that might replace the toxic drug supply. And at every step of the way, the offer is abstinence, is just don't do drugs. Don't do drugs. Maybe we'll fund a bed for you to go lie in while you go to a 12-step program during the day, where you learn don't do drugs. And there are some places in BC that are now beginning to offer, you know, Suboxone or something like that. But this is the primary, still the primary go-to of most places in North America, is that you should get a 12-step program. If the Alberta model is to have its way, that would be the only game in town.
One thing I'm interested if you could explain to us is, why doesn't the abstinence-only model work? Like, what's wrong with it? Why doesn't it help people?
You know, even if you look at the literature produced by some of those same groups, you know, like 12-step groups, it's kind of a coin toss whether it's going to stick or not. What they told me, because I spent a long time going to 12-step groups, and they said, well, you'll relapse. This will happen. You got to keep coming back, keep coming back. And everybody in the group would talk about, oh, they went to 12-step for a while. They went out and used again, they came back and they said, keep coming back. The system works, or the program works, if you work it. The problem with that though is now you could die You know, so some people, it takes years to get there. Some people like me, abstinence never stuck for me. But along the way in these programs, you are supposed to make a searching and fearless moral inventory. And that means you're to identify your own moral defects and, you know, maybe go apologize to people that you've wronged and all this. And I think there's something to apologizing if you've screwed somebody over, but searching yourself for these problems and trying to delete them and actively turning away from the structural forces in your life that may have f***ed things up. It seems like gaslighting to me, you know, because every time you try to think about any other structural force that might be going on in somebody's life, you might have a sponsor around this as well. No, you're just rationalizing your drug use. You know, you're just trying to make up a nice sociological excuse to go get high. And that doesn't work, because when people's lives are, going down a certain path, you kind of need something else. To me, it's like first aid. You know, it's like if you have a car crash or something like that, and you're like, no, it's full health only. We don't do first aid at the side of the road. They just have to hit rock bottom. They have to crawl to the hospital or something like that. Harm reduction's first aid. It's triage, you know? It's a super important step.
What you said, Garth, about how these abstinence-only clinics encourage you to keep coming back. Maybe I'm being overly cynical, but I don't think so. But I mean, a lot of these clinics cost a lot of money to attend. So it is, in a sense, in their own interest to have people relapse and then keep coming back. Now, in Alberta, the government made a whole spectacle of them eliminating fees for publicly funded beds at private clinics in Alberta. So these companies are still, I mean, they're not for profit, so they're not making profits. They're still in line to get some funding if you keep relapsing and coming back.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing, the way I saw it is we would all measure our clean time, right? And you would count it in days. And I know some people who've succeeded this way, a few, and they're very proud to have, you know, 10 years or whatever. But you count it, and at the end of a meeting, you come up and you get a keychain that is got color that represents if you've had a days or weeks or months or years or something. And, for me, I always just got the white keychain. It's like, it says just for today. And that means that you have no time. But the problem is it's like an odometer on your car, you know, one of those old ones that goes up and up and up. But then if you use once, it flips to zero. And so it just puts this huge pressure on you. Like you've completely failed. Like it's digital. It's either you're clean or you're not. And it's very hard. Whereas harm reduction just says, well, okay, you've managed to use at a safe injection site where someone can give you Narcan and prevent your overdose if it's too much. You've managed to use a little bit first. You've managed to use not alone, or maybe you're smoking instead of injecting, or maybe there's some other way, or maybe you're taking methadone so that you don't have to use quite as much of the toxic street drug. Those are considered successes, right? It's like the person can define for themselves what their goals are. And I mean, it seems like a very small goal, but the goal of all public health programs first should be to stop the deaths and everything else second. So this is the big disconnect in Alberta, is that Jason, the two Jasons, seem to be more worried about people using drugs than people dying. So they're aiming squarely at their ideas all on, oh my God, we don't want people to use drugs. We don't want people to get high, instead of we want people to be alive. And those are completely different things.
Yeah, you can't get clean if you're dead. And I think the way the government has approached it is like strictly as a moral issue, like the idea that drug use is morally bad, therefore people who use drugs are morally bad or have some kind of moral defect. And I think what I find like so deeply reprehensible about that is not only like the direct harm it leads to in terms of like people not being able to get help and using drugs that are unsafe, but also just like, if you look at any research on drug use and on the opioid crisis and the opioid epidemic, opioid use tracks very strongly with deindustrialization, tracks very strongly with the financial crash, with poverty, with not being able to find a job, with our society collapsing around you.
Hey, absolutely.
And yeah, like what I find so frustrating about it is that like these are the same people who've created all of those problems. And then when people's lives are unbearable and for whatever reason they end up using drugs, it's not the society you live in that, you know, created the conditions for drug use. It's that you're morally a bad person.
Yeah, I mean, you think about the really UCP.
It's just a really upsettingly grotesque way.
Yeah, and you think about the UCP, right? They like to pretend to be blue-collar resource workers, right? Like they like to have Bernard the Roughneck around them or whatever. And like I call bull on that, first of all, but I was a resource worker. Like I would fly to a mine in Northwest Territories out of Edmonton, and I worked in the mill, and people worked underground. And when you got off of your two-week shift where you worked 12 hours a day and you got out of that camp that was nowhere near a city, you bloody well wanted to party. Right. And maybe if you got hurt, you wanted to party a little bit differently. Like you wanted to address the pain that you maybe got at the place. And maybe if you got laid off, you were doing something different, but it's all drug use. And so the people that they are stigmatizing in Alberta, the people that Jason Kenney and Jason Lewin do not like are resource workers, are unemployed resource workers. Like, my God, same in BC and Alberta, like people doing a bunch of coke on the weekend to blow off steam. That's like tradition, you know? So it's not just everyone being wired daily opioid user like me. People just also want to party. And half of the people who are dying of overdose come to it that way.
Was a highlight from a legacy episode of The Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Since launching in October 2022, Sources has provided in-depth interviews with experts and newsmakers across the country from the award-winning journalists at Press Progress. On this excerpt from a new episode, Ontario reporter Eric Wickham and The Trillium's Jack Houghton speak to all the bills beloved by Doug Ford as his progressive conservative government continues to dismantle the province. Here's a highlight from that conversation.
This is Sources by Press Progress, on location today. I'm your Ontario reporter, Eric Wickham.
I'm Associate Editor Jonathan Goldsby.
Jonathan, thank you for joining me today. What are we doing here?
We are sweating, first of all. It's a very warm Tuesday morning at the end of June in downtown Toronto. It's either 22 degrees if you go by the temperature at one airport, or 31 degrees if you go by the temperature at the other airport. And I find in downtown Toronto, it tends to be in the middle. And it's a, bright summer morning. It's garbage day, so you get the scent of that. Also, it's that last week of June, so with the Acanthus altissima or whatever it is blooming, and that's the tree that smells like, listeners can Google that if they want. Acanthus altissima, that's it.
That is like a perfect way of explaining how it feels out here right now. This is the most outdoorsy podcast I've ever done for Sources. Oh, yeah. This is a departure for us, but we're on the lawn of Queen's Park right now.
Yeah, we're on the front lawn of Queen's Park, and there's a giant Canadian flag draped across the front as though this were like some sort of concert for recovery from SARS. And there's a lone legislative peace officer marching back and forth, keeping an eye on the newly uncovered Johnny McDonald statue.
Queen's Park is no longer in session. They're taking a break for several months. Our listeners are also getting ready to enjoy their holidays on the long weekends, but we have a big policy episode ahead of us.
Woo! Yeah, no, I took the Canadian flag as just like, just to eliminate any ambiguity there may have been about where we are. Maybe you mean it's more like a sort of like a gone fishing type sign, like gone Canada daying. But to me, yeah, the government has I wouldn't say they've gotten a lot done, but they have done a lot. Does that make sense?
I think that's exactly it. The provincial government has been very busy, and they have introduced and passed a lot of legislation in a very short amount of time, which presents us with two problems. It's difficult to report on many different things at once with the correct amount of scrutiny, and people don't like hearing about too much policy all at once. It's not super fun.
I mean, I mean, you could call sources, the subtitle of the show could be Too Much Policy All at Once. I mean, that's kind of the gist of the show. But I think we're also going to try to find ways to make part of the challenge of journalism generally and podcasting in particular is how do you make challenging discussions, complex discussions, important discussions, compelling, interesting, engaging. And you're the Ontario Reporter, Eric, and you know, you're talking about, yeah, there are so many freaking bills that have come down in the past few months, which, I mean, it's kind of almost easy to forget that, you know, there was an Ontario election earlier this year, and so they're acting as though they're, you know, a new government with a new or at least renewed mandate, and which they, you know, I guess they are to the extent that that's a meaningful term, but they've had passed a lot of legislation that has the potential, the very strong potential, to be transformative. And trying to take that from abstract into something tangible and something real, that's sort of where this episode came from. How do we try to attach a physical reality to these things that, for now, are just sort of floating out there in the ether waiting to be implemented?
Absolutely. So we're going to walk and talk about how specific policy from the Ford government could or will be affecting physical spaces right here in Toronto. And I'll also be joined by reporter Jack Howen from the Trillium to really drill down on these topics while we wander around the city and sweat a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So should we get going?
Yes. I imagine Jack right now is in his nice air-conditioned office.
Jack, welcome to Sources.
Thanks for having me.
So Queen's Park is taking what Rob Ferguson in The Star is calling an unusually long summer break, and it's returning October 20th. With the election earlier this year and the Christmas break set to start mid-December, has there been another year in recent memory where provincial politicians spent so little time in session? And what are a couple of Ontario reporters going to do while they're off?
Yeah, it is a long break, if you want to call it a break, which a lot of people do. They do constituency work. Some of them do a lot of work, you know, helping people navigate things that, you know, are confusing systems and whatnot. But yeah, they will not be facing question period or the media as much. Yeah, it's going to be a long time. So we're going to be working, chipping away on like investigative stuff, trying to see what news is out there every day.
It feels like such a tone shift just because the last couple months there have been so many bills, it feels like, and bills that have already got royal assent, some that are in second reading stage. There's a lot of stuff that has happened in Ontario in this small amount of time that the legislature was meeting. Would you mind if we went through some of those together today?
Absolutely. And this is their justification, by the way, for why it's such a long break, because they got so much done.
It's a little self-congratulatory, but you know, I guess you can't say that they didn't do a lot of work.
Totally.
So we're here on the lawn of Queen's Park, where hundreds of First Nations people protested Bill 5 right here on Monday, June 2nd. The bill passed, though. Jonathan, what do people need to know about Bill 5?
Bill 5 is the Protecting Ontario by Unleashing Our Economy Act, which, even as far as the names of bill that they choose for the bills, is quite an interesting one. I had to pause to wrap my head around that metaphor. Protecting Ontario by Unleashing Our Economy. So is our economy like some sort of guard dog in this scenario? Some sort of Rottweiler? Like, what else? You unleash something to protect something. Like, is there anything else metaphorically that one unleashes to protect something? So we're you having our economy bark at people to keep them out? Isn't that the opposite of what it's supposed to do? It's a very muddled premise, but I guess that's kind of the point. It's kind of turns the idea of the economy inside out. I guess it kind of turns the idea of like the province's physical earth inside out. So, I mean, you've been tracking Bill 5, Eric, and all of its implications, but of course, you know who else has been tracking it? Jack Howen from the Trillium. And I'm glad you got to talk to him to get even more insight into what this means and why people are so understandably freaked out.
Can you briefly explain what Bill 5 is supposed to be for and why people are concerned about these special economic zones that the bill allows?
Yeah, so under Bill 5, Cabinet will have the power to designate certain areas, any area, as a special economic zone, as you mentioned. So that means that within those zones, certain proponents, certain people, companies that are going to be doing resource extraction projects mostly, will be exempt from certain provincial laws or regulations. And if it sounds like I'm being vague, it's because the law is pretty vague. They're allowed to be exempted from any provincial law or regulation, technically, which includes any municipal bylaw. And the Ford government has positioned it as a way to speed up getting minerals out of the ground, speeding up the Ring of Fire, getting it done, as it were, to unleash the economy. But a lot of people have concerns about the amount of power the government is giving itself and what that power could be used for. It's a theme right now, as the federal government is also trying to do the same thing with Bill C-5. But there are some key differences there, which my editor, Jessica Smith-Karras, actually wrote about recently. Basically, Ontario's is more broad and could open itself up to constitutional challenges for that reason.
I guess the topic of focus for Bill 5 right now is the Ring of Fire. First Nations groups are speaking out about Ford's push to make the Ring of Fire a special economic zone, which prompted Ford to say a few things at a press conference that were criticized as racist, which he more or less apologized for later. Why is Ford so insistent about mining on this land, right? The Ring of Fire is on Treaty 9 territory. And why would the people living there, despite what Ford says about the economic benefits, might not be thrilled with this project?
Yeah, like you said, the Ring of Fire has a long history, and it's been perhaps the central economic theme or push from the Ford government, especially in the past few years. Basically, the government wants to create sort of a closed loop for EV manufacturing. So getting the minerals out of the ground in the Ring of Fire to actually making the cars down in Southwest Ontario. Whether or not that'll work and how many billions of dollars we're going to have to spend attracting companies to set up shop remains to be seen. And how many roadblocks there are in terms of the communities that have been on this land for a long time also remains to be seen. But yeah, you can understand if you live near this future mining area or in it, the government saying, well, you know, we're going to bypass these checks and balances would be concerning. Now, the government has said that it's not going to affect the duty to consult. They're still going to consult with First Nations. Ford, as you mentioned, seemed to get a little frustrated the other day and said that First Nations can't keep coming hat in hand, was the quote, saying, give me money, but putting up roadblocks to mining projects, which, yeah, some people took as racist. Saul Mamakwa, the NDP Indigenous relations critic, called it racist. And for the next day, apologized, said, I sincerely apologize. He had a meeting with the Anishinaabeg Nation. The Grand Chief there said she and her chiefs accepted the apology and they're moving forward, but they remain opposed to Bill 5. So that's going to be certainly something to keep an eye on.
Bill 5 also has implications for other conservation efforts, as I understand it. How will this bill help the province circumvent protections for habitats of at-risk species?
Yeah, so it does away with the Endangered Species Act and replaces it with something else that essentially every environmental group you ask about it says offers far weaker protections. And it also empowers cabinet to exempt projects from archaeological assessment requirements, which Indigenous leaders have said could put sacred sites at risk for obvious reasons.
All right, Jonathan, where are we now?
We are just opposite the legislature on Queen's Park Crescent East. There is a corgi crossing the street and a little cute terrier-type dog behind it.
We are here for a specific reason, and that is because there is a bike lane.
It's a very nice bike lane. It's like semi-separated. Well, so when you get a little north of here, it's fully separated. But there's a nice little concrete bollards. It makes Queen's Park Crescent bikeable. It makes it possible to bike down from College Street to Bloor Street without necessarily holding on to your handlebars for dear life. Although that's not a bad default to have, just to be wary, but it makes it bearable and, dare I say it, even pleasant.
Right, and I'm not a city biker. I do not ride a bike in the city, but I do understand the utility of that. These bike lanes are no longer going to exist.
Oh, yeah. It really is amazing. You know, I feel like I've become one of those people who said, well, I went to Europe and told people there, but yeah, but I did go to Europe and mention to someone there, like, oh, you know, Toronto's actually, because of Ontario, getting rid of bike lanes. And, of course, just astonished, because, I mean, even if it weren't in a that conversation didn't happen to take place in a bike-friendly city. It is genuinely unusual, if not perhaps even unique, to be a place that actually spends money to remove bike lanes, to remove bicycle infrastructure. Like that is genuinely world-class in its extreme weirdness.
I mean, there's so much to talk about with these bike lanes. I feel like everyone's sick of hearing about them, but I do think there's a lot of important